Kevin Merz.
Miss, we have Kirk on the line. We're talking about the Hebrew word for work, which I think, abad, which I think is best translated act upon and engage in. In fact, virtually every time I see abad in Hebrew, I render it act upon and engage in. And it always works in that
context.
Yeah, almost always in that context. That is the best rendering of abad. It can also mean to serve in the sense of you want to engage in and act upon the terms and conditions of the family, which would have you be serving on behalf of that family. That's what we're attempting to do here. Service can be a good thing.
Sure. It even says in the one of the definitions I dug up was to work, perform, or perform work for another out of an obligation, well, or a requirement, or out of gratitude. I mean, all of those are absolutely fine, you know, when it comes
I don't like the word obligation in any
Think of it this way. You know, Yahweh has a contract, and he's obliged to do what he agreed, as we are obliged to do what, and that's
and obliged is from obligation, and I guess I don't have a problem with obliged, because that's, you know, it's when you agree to do something in a contract.
Live up to the agreement,
Live up to the agreement. You're obliged to live up to the agreement. And obligated just sounds too obeyish.
I know where you're going there, but still, you know.
Obliged just is.
If I shook your hand and gave you my word, I'm going to do something, then. And
you're obliged, you're obliged to honor what you
get out there, as we say, you're obliged to go do it. You know,
that's right.
Fine.
Yeah. Say what you mean and do what you say.
Yes, exactly. And you know, when we left, I was we were talking about the there's a couple of things in the work. There's the pleasure of actually just doing the work. I mean, I get a lot of pleasure in just painting or playing golf or my building little business we had and all that sort of thing. So there's a great joy in just the actual doing of it. And then there's also a great joy in the results. You know, if you do a decent job and you produce fruit, then that's wonderful too. I mean, so it's a double-sided coin, and not a double-sided coin, but it's, you know, a lot of pleasure in both the doing and the results of it. So
I don't do what we do here from a sense of obligation or even because I'm obliged to do it.
No.
I don't do it out of a sense of gratitude even. You know, I'm grateful for being a part of Yahweh's covenant family. Absolutely grateful. But I don't do this out of that sense of gratitude. It's not it's a, you were really kind and generous and merciful, to cite the antithesis of the goddess's name, merciful to me, and your offer is so wonderful, and I'm enjoying this relationship. Out of a sense of gratitude, I'm going to share what I have, what you've said with others. That's not my motivation. My motivation is just strictly, I can't help myself.
Yeah, and it's also fun.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I can't help myself. I find that when you learn that, first of all, when you learn that others are being abused by religious and political lies, that if you have any character, if you've got any sense of compassion, then you're motivated to expose those lies. And that's just because it's the right thing to do. And second, when you share Yah's truth and how vastly superior it is to man's lies, there's a sense of great satisfaction and joy. It's like contributing to one's family. It's like nurturing one's family. And so there's a satisfaction there, and there's a sense of satisfaction, of value, and of fun associated with doing things that are part of God's family. I mean, I do it because it's the right thing to do. I do it because I can't help myself. I do it because I enjoy it. It's a fun thing to learn and to share.
And as Arnold Palmer said, if it ain't fun, don't do it.
Yeah, if it ain't fun, don't do it. Yeah, and by the way, that was that is my approach to writing these books, to doing this program. That is my approach. I won't even say it's my approach. I've sensed right from the beginning with Yahweh that his guidance in this regard as to how much you should do, what you should do, when you should do. Like, you know, right now I probably have in my inbox on Yada Yada 100 to 200 unanswered emails.
Wow.
The emails just take so much time, and you know everybody, they're personal, and you and you know that you ought to do it, but it's sometimes they're just so long. Like I was sent one the other day. This guy was talking about Paul and prophecy, and he must have written 8 pages, It would not be fun for me to dive into the middle of that. I just wouldn't find it fun. And
you should tell them to call in, and I'll shut up. It's okay. I'll go downstairs and get another cup of coffee.
Who suggests that I want to deal with it there and want you to?
Oh, okay.
I might be that I would go brew a cup of coffee.
But, you do it.
But, you know, it's that's not the fun part of it. And so I have a tendency to let it slide. Is that right? No. For example, not too long ago, we were doing a series of programs on the exemption that Yahweh made on food. If you're thinking about it, he made an exemption for a thinking individual regarding food, and Yahusha affirmed it when he said, "Eat what's put before you." And man, did I ever get attacked on that. I mean, ruthlessly. And all the attacks were designed to do one thing, which was to destroy what little credibility some might think that I have, which I wouldn't claim to have any credibility. But still, it just isn't fun to be sharing things that you're doing your best to translate the testimony, and then people just come at you and attack your character and contribution and everything. It's not fun. And so the first response is just don't go there anymore.
Yeah.
And so either you don't do it because it's not fun, or you say, you know, I'm just going to ignore them because the rest of it is fun. And I chose in this case, you know, I'm just going to ignore them. I don't care what they say. And I'm not going to read what they say. I'm not going to respond to what they say because that's not fun. What is fun is sharing these insights.
And discovering. And every time you translate something, you get a little something more. I mean, it's really phenomenal to me. I mean, I didn't do a lot of this the last number of years. I just do occasional. But now I've kind of delved into it, and it's remarkable. I mean,
and you do it because it's fun, right?
Oh, it is. I mean, it's tiring. I mean, I don't want to tell anybody because especially if you do it the way I do it. I mean,
it takes a lot of time.
I have about enough computer skill to look up a football score, but that's about it. You know, well, maybe a tiny bit more, but not much.
Yeah, you're the ultimate holdback to the analog world.
Yeah, I still draw with a pencil.
Yeah, you know, you do for me what in one area what Larry does in the other. You know, I was always considered too abrupt, too blunt. And so Larry, by comparison to me, is even more blunt. So, you know, I'm softy compared to Larry as Mr. Meany. Not like he's not mean, but it's, you know, I really like having Larry around because everybody gets mad at Larry as opposed to me. And I consider myself to be the holdback to the analog world. But I like analog. I've never been comfortable in the digital world, even though I had an internet company that I founded, but I've never been comfortable in the digital worlds. But you're even more.
I'm so far removed.
Draw me a picture.
Listen, I quit about halfway fax machine. I thought the fax machine was the greatest thing in the world. I could write down. I didn't have to use a typewriter. I could just write it down, and I could draw a picture to show you what I'm talking about and send it over. And that's why I communicated with my vendors. I'd say, look, this part on the easel is broken. I need this part.
Yeah, there you go.
It looks just like this.
Yeah. So, you know, my eldest son is a aeronautical engineer, and he was like me in the sense that the computer was that black box, and he wanted to be an experimental engineer, so that you were actually doing things with your hand. You had a tangible object that you were examining, and you were analyzing, and you were trying to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he loved. So it was kind of the analog part of engineering. But there's very little engineering today that is analog. Mm-hmm. Everything is modeled on the computer.
Yes, sir.
And so he would, when he graduated, he would constantly turn down even interviews for computational engineering because he was uncomfortable with that, and he was comfortable with that which was tangible, that you could really get your mind and hands around. And as it turned out, that every job was computational today, and he was just saying, no, I'm not qualified, I shouldn't even interview. So the company that actually invented computational engineering and is the world's most acclaimed at it ended up hiring him. And what he does now is he translates the computational analysis of engineering modeling into the real world for the other computational engineers. He says, okay, he actually programs the analysis, and he reads the data, and he says to the others, says, this is what it means in the real world regarding this particular part.
Oh, yeah.
Found out, you know, there's a niche. Niche for explaining what's happening in that black box.
It is. That's the kind of stuff that would, for this last generation, they're hoping we'll lay down and die, as my wife likes to say. But there's a whole bunch of us, I bet, that are still out there that this is just over our heads. We just, you know. So if you make
it's just like when we began to talk about translating Hebrew and then Hebrew grammar, and when you found out that there really is no Hebrew grammar. There's Hebrew relationships with the stems. There's ongoing or one-time events with the conjugations. There is choice or volition with the moods. And once you came to realize that, it wasn't about grammar anymore. It's about relationships and about choice and about ongoing behavior versus completed acts. And then when we said, you know, you really don't have to speak Hebrew. You can just look at the letters and come to understand the words. What you found is, okay, there's a way in my wheelhouse to enjoy this. I can guide a ship through all of this because I just found that I have a proclivity, you know, and speaking for you here, for those things. I have found that that I didn't have to speak and be fluent in Hebrew, that I had a proclivity for making connections. And if you look at Hebrew words, all you have to do is connect them to who Yahweh is and what he's offering, and it all fits together. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We, from our last bit of our conversation, what I think we have deduced, Kurt, is that it's not about processing speed, which people would call raw intelligence. You know, IQ is your ability to process that is what is being measured. Our, the speed to which we process information isn't what's what matters. What matters is that we can bring our unique proclivities to the task, the abad, of Yahweh's testimony, his word, his Torah. And we can use our own skill sets to derive insights and meaning and come to understanding. It's just, you do it a little different way than I do it. And I suspect, Kirk, that in eternity, this is going to be the thing that makes it interesting, is that we're not going to agree on everything. We're going to bring unique perspectives. You know, you're going to keep your accent in eternity, and we're going to enjoy it. And you're going to visualize things as an artist does in eternity. And I'm going to be there trying to make connections between things, and the interplay between that will be far more interesting than if we saw everything exactly the same way. Kirk, I hear silence.
Yeah, where you can see all different. I mean, if you got a language like this, you certainly can have a universe that has so many sides to it you could explore it forever. You know, and find something new to see in it each time. That's the beauty of it all. So,
are you surprised that the language that was used to conceive the universe and to conceive the life that is in the universe is graphic and pictorial?
Well, it only proves that Yahweh was the first artist in it.
It does, doesn't it? I always thought he was the first mathematician, but you're right, he was the first artist.
Yeah, he drew pictures before anybody knew, before anybody was there to know what a picture was.
Yeah, he was a combination of things, really. He was the first mathematician, because this is, everything is a formula. He was the first artist, because he spoke the universe into existence using words that were pictures.
Side note here, don't you think he might have did that for us? He knew he was going to create us, and there's no way we were smart enough to know thing, so
I'm going to draw you pictures.
I'm going to draw you pictures.
That's really funny. How many times did we say, "Let me draw you a picture"? And he did. In his literally the jots and tittles that comprise his Torah draw us a picture. And Avad is just a perfect example. It's the perspective that provides understanding on the doorway to his family home. That's why we are in an environment where work is important. Once we were outside of that home, with Adam and Chawa being booted out, once we were outside of the home, we needed a perspective on the doorway to that home. Did Yahwa have to engage? Did he have to do something to provide the doorway for that home for us to enter his home?
Well, absolutely. He was the doorway.
Yeah, he became the Passover lamb. He engaged in a sacrifice, didn't he?
Right.
And he was the welcome mat in the sense of he took on all of our crud and Sheol so that we would cross through that threshold perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And since everything in the universe came from him, now he's in the seventh dimension and, you know, we're down here in the third dimension, but since everything in the universe came from him, don't you suspect that he's going to contribute to all of our empowerment, all of our enrichment, to that which makes us eternal?
Well, that's the whole point of engaging in. I mean, act upon, engage in. That's what he's doing. Sure.
It's what we do for family.
It's what we
do for our children. It's what he wants to do. You want to know what Yahweh wants? He wants to enjoy his family. He wants to spend time with his family. He wants to go explore the universe with his family. He wants to camp out with his family. That's what he wants. That's all God wants. That's what he wants. And he wants that family to be as like him as is possible. And like him in the sense of wanting the same things.
Yeah. It's plain.
So I think Abad shows that Yahweh acts upon the covenant. He engages. He's obliged. He stuck out his hand to say, this is what I have committed to do. My word is my bond. I've said what I mean. I've done what I've said.
Mm-hmm.
And
you can count on it.
And you can count on it. He's obliged to follow through, to do what he said. We can count on it. There are five benefits for the covenant. We can count on them. We're going to be made immortal. We're going to be perfected. We're adopted. We're enriched. And we're empowered. He's obliged. I don't even mind saying in his case, obligated.
In his case, yeah.
Yeah, obligated.
Well, he said, he can't take it away from him. If you engage your part, he will absolutely guarantee he's doing his part.
That is correct. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kirk, why don't we resume this testimony that Yahweh had to say about the circumcision, and consider the words that are in that statement. He began very clearly telling us that he said, and God Almighty, this would be from Elohim, said, promised, affirmed. So that's the Amar there is very much consistent with this concept of God being obligated, promised, obliged to Abraham, merciful father. So as for you, you should actually and continuously observe. I mean, this is the third statement that the third request that Yahweh made for covenant participation. The first was, hello, my name is Yahweh. I want you to walk away from your country. That was the first. The second was, rather than rely on your country, I want you to rely on me.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore walk to me and become perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just walk away from your country. You can walk away from your country in any direction. He wants us to walk away from our country in the direction that he is. which would be down the seven steps that lead to camping out with him. So as for you, you should actually continuously observe. This was the third request. He's telling us that we should continuously, this was written in the imperfect, and call stem, which speaks of something that is literal. So you should literally and continuously observe.
Mm-hmm.
What? What did he want us to constantly and literally observe? Was it
instruction? Yeah.
The law on the Sabbath?
No.
No. Was it the kosher food laws as enacted by the rabbis?
Hardly.
No. Was it the Constitution of the United States of America? Was it was it some religious mandate?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So he said, there's only one thing here that I want you to constantly and continuously and literally observe. What was that thing that Yahweh asked Abraham to observe? And he could have picked anything in the world.
Yeah.
What did he pick?
It was his words, his instruction, his guidance, his teaching.
Yeah. It was his family, his covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically. Now, you can't observe the covenant unless you're reading his guidance, his testimony, and his Torah about his covenant. So your answer happens to be accurate. You've just thought about, well, how do I do that? You go one step beyond and you say, all right, he's just said, I want you to constantly observe my family. Now, he's not telling Abraham that he wants him to focus on his spiritual family. Abraham can't even see his spiritual family.
No.
And the spiritual family hadn't even been conceived at that point. Abraham was going to be the first participant, and Abraham wasn't even part of it yet. He was journeying towards it. So, observe can't be rendered here as obey, because there were no conditions at this, really.
No.
I mean, there were two statements at this point. Walk to me and become perfect and walk away from your country. But those aren't laws.
No.
That's direction.
No, an invitation to a party
That's
is not
guidance.
A law.
Right. Oh, those are both guidance. This is the direction you ought to go.
Mm-hmm.
Away from man, towards me. That's guidance. That's all that is guidance.
Right.
It's not a law. And so when he's telling us, Abraham and us through him, to constantly and literally observe his covenant, then the only way, there's only one way that Abraham could do that, which is to consider, closely examine and carefully consider everything that Yahweh had to say about it.
Had to say, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, didn't he also tell him a little bit earlier or somewhere along in there to actually write these things down?
Nope. Nope. What he told us is that he gave Abraham his Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So those who say, you know, like Paul did, you know, the Torah didn't exist at the time of Abraham, so the covenant, the Torah could not have saved Abraham. He had to be saved by faith is nonsense. Yahweh specifically says he gave his Torah. Now, since God's immortal, since God doesn't change, could he have given a written copy of his Torah to Abraham?
It could have been.
He said he did. He said he did. Now, so it could be Torah could just mean I gave my teaching and guidance to Abraham. He guided him away from Babylon and guided him to the promised land, his home. So Torah could just mean guidance, but he could have actually given a copy of his Torah to Abraham. There's no reason for him not to have done so.
Well, he wouldn't even need everything, all the stuff. You know, it keeps growing. More and more is revealed to us, but he had the heart of it. That was that was the only thing that was really disturbing me before I ran across your translations was I kept thinking to myself, well, why can't we be more like Abraham? That was very simple, what God asked of him and their bond, their relationship. Why can't it be like that? And everything is crucial was given to Abraham.
So as for you, you should actually and continuously observe my family-oriented covenant relationship, my home, and you and your seed, your offspring after you. throughout their generations, dwelling places, and eras of time. Dor means wherever you are, whenever you are, throughout time, no matter where you are. So if you're an offspring of the covenant, you're a beneficiary of the covenant, you're adopted into Yahweh's covenant family, it doesn't matter when you live or where you live or who you're related to genetically, because it's every generation, every dwelling place, all eras of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we take Glenn's call here, let's just take us back to where we left off yesterday. Okay. This one and only family-oriented covenant relationship of mine, which relationally and beneficially you should actually and continuously observe between and for the purpose of understanding me, and between you and for the purpose of being aware, to understand, making connections, and between your seed, your offspring, after you, for them to understand, for you to actually circumcise according to your every male, for them to remember. Before we examine those letters, hello, Glenn, it's good to hear from you. How are you today?
I'm all right, thanks. You talk too much, John. Instead of picking up my call, you stole my thunder.
Oh.
I was going to call in and say, somebody is somewhere is going to say, but Abraham didn't have a Torah, because that got written down later.
Okay,
I
hear you now, Glenn.
I was calling it, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Oh, I started off by saying, I say you talk too much, because instead of picking up my call, you stole my thunder.
Uh-oh. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I would prefer you to have said it than me to have said it. What were you going to say that me said?
I was going to call an end to say that somebody somewhere is going to say, but there was no Torah at the time of Abraham. That was written down later by a guy named Moshe. So I was going to point out that his understanding of God's instructions had to come through his relationship by the Ruach Kodesh and his interaction with Yahweh that way.
Yeah, why do you think that Yahweh told us that he gave his Torah to Abraham? Why would he tell us that?
I suspect that he was in a living, real-time, interactive relationship via the Ruach Kodesh, and he was giving him his instructions for him, you know, at that time. Plus, you speak about the Holy Spirit, the Ruach Kodesh, you know, eventually writing God's instructions on our hearts. I think it's entirely possible that God, to some degree, you know, does this intuitively, you know, by his spirit. Yahweh was directly communicating with Abraham. So,
it's not the set apart spirit that writes the Torah on our hearts. It's Yahweh says that he is doing it. Now, Yahweh can do it through the set apart spirit if he wishes, because that's a non-diminished manifestation, but a set apart manifestation of him. And so he could do it that way if he wished to, and it'd still be Yahweh. But it's Yahweh does not designate how he's doing it. He just says that he...
Hello?
I incorporated into the very fabric of our lives.
On that point, like, by, okay, now you're saying Yahweh. So, you know, certainly it's all Yahweh, you know, regardless of his manifestation, whether by the Ruach Kodesh or to Yahusha. But by what means would you suggest then that Abraham perceived Yahweh? You know, how did Yahweh manifest to Abraham?
He told us so. I don't have to have any conjecture here. Yahweh told us he appeared as an individual to to Abraham. And one time he actually describes himself as appearing as three individuals, probably to replicate the diminished set apart manifestation of Yahweh and Yahusha, as well as a tangible representation of the set apart spirit, so that he would have a comprehensive appreciation of Yahweh. But he, Yahweh was very clear. He introduced himself to Abraham as an individual, and he refers to Abraham as a friend. So that's how he did it. But I think that, Glenn, there's other reasons in addition to the one that you gave, that Yahweh was constantly providing guidance. The first three requests for the covenant, the first two are strictly guidance, they're strictly direction. Walk away from your country, Babylon. Walk to me. And the third, to I want you to continuously and literally observe my covenant. In that case, that's teaching. That's instruction and teaching. So he has already defined Torah: direction, guidance, instruction, and teaching, with the first three statements. And so I think all of that makes a great deal of sense. But I also suspect that Yahweh gave Abraham a written copy of his Torah. He said, "I gave him his Torah." I don't think there's any reason for us to suspect it was anything other than his Torah. And I suspect that he did so for two reasons that we have not yet mentioned. And when we return, I want to speak about the two reasons in addition to the two that we've spoken about as to why. Welcome back to the final segment today of Sharing This. I suspect that there were two additional reasons that Yahweh provided his direction and guidance to Abraham, that he went on to provide his instruction and teaching to Abraham. And the first of those is, if he specifically says that I have provided my Torah to him, then when he tells us through Abraham that a condition for participating in his covenant is to closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of the covenant, then we know, because he gave his Torah to Abraham, and the Torah is the only place where the covenant is presented and discussed, that that's where we should, that's the document that we should closely examine and carefully consider. If does not mention having given his Torah to Abraham, then we have to speculate as to what it is that we should examine and consider to act upon this instruction. So I think that's the primary reason he said that he gave his Torah to Abraham. I think there's another reason, and that is that God doesn't like deceit and deceivers. God despises Paul. And so I think God specifically told us that he gave his Torah to Abraham so that anyone who is trying to objectively compare what Paul wrote to what God had to say would find that Paul is an absolute, unadulterated liar. And I think God likes it that way. That if you're willing to look under that rug of Pauline dogma, you'll find the truth. Kirk, what do you think? Do you think those are valid additions?
Absolutely. The only thing I was coming up with is because he was the head of the family, the most mm-hmm. important family, then he needs to know as much information, you know, because his job, when we get down to the last word, the car, you know, that meant the member of the family, the male of the family who passed down all the family history and the family name, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So right. This being the most important family, he's got to be armed with everything that's necessary to establish his family. So, and that would be his most, so the Torah was absolutely fit there.
That would have to be a little mind-blowing for Abraham, you know, reading all that future history. Reading there, it's like, wait a minute, what?
Yahweh actually told Abraham that your descendants will endure the 400 years in Egypt. He actually told them that they would be there in a land that not their own, and so and that they would be slaves there. So Abraham was fully aware of that future history, and they discussed what was going to happen at Lot, and I mean to Lot, and they discussed the future of Sodom and Gomorrah. So
he probably wasn't not much at that point.
I mean, I would agree that having to create the universe takes some time out of his busy schedule to discuss future history with you, and particularly your own. Like, oh, by the way, your wife, who has been barren for 90 years, she's going to get pregnant. I know you're 100, but your wife's going to get pregnant. You're going to have a son through her. That's a fairly mind-blowing, I mean, just a personal bit of future history, right?
Yeah, that makes Abraham, like, the person, like, most privy to a whole lot of, you know, future history, you know, like, more than anyone else, you know, is very explicit.
Right.
Stuff,
when Abraham says, you know, I don't get it, I have no idea what I'm inheriting, I'm an old guy, and I don't have a son or a daughter, I don't have any child, so you keep on talking about inheritance associated with this covenant, I don't get what I'm inheriting, and Yahweh took him to heaven and then took him to the light of the stars.
Right.
that was as big as it gets in terms of him seeing the ultimate future history, right?
Right.
He saw eternity.
Wow.
Yeah. That would blow my little mind, I'll tell you.
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that changed everything.
That's a lot of stuff. Yeah.
A lot of stuff to absorb. But, you know, I think he gave it to Abraham at about the level, about the flow rate, at about the time that Abraham could absorb it without, having all the gears wheel out of control in that in his mind, and I think he does the same thing for us. I think we get to come to know who he is at our own speed. You know, some of us might have a little faster speed and a little different approach, but we get to do it at our own proclivity and at our own speed, and we find all different perspectives on this beautiful jewel. All different perspectives. That's what's going to make eternity fun. It's going to be fun to have